I turn the arms of a Glenn.
And John.
And Drew.
And this is our makeup show. Sorry, sort of. Sorry, not sorry. That Drew deleted the other show.
Yeah. She was just like, you know what? These guys are assholes.
Fuck this show. It was a good show. Accidentally, we had a computer problem, and the show just crashed. It happened once before.
Yeah, it did. It happened when we did one of our $10 and above shows.
Oh, yeah, one of our extra shows. That's right. That was a killer one. I remember that. Yeah. We did our $10 and above extra show for the month, and it was a killer show. And Drew paused it, and shit came. We spent like 30 minutes on the phone with Adam trying to figure out how to recover it. And in the end, he was like, not happening, dude. So, oops. Anyways, last week's show got deleted. Then we got into crazy freaking busy with training and everything. We were training every single day for like many days.
Yeah.
And I am glad to have a day of not training today, that we'll be back at it again tomorrow. So, yeah, good stuff. But we're going to jump right into the show. But we are still going to do a Red Wire Gear moment.
Oh.
Yeah. So, extra show for you guys this week, technically from last week, but Red Wire Gear moment, and begin.
The dog leashes. So, originally when we did this, I was talking about the pre-order for the dog leashes. If you've already watched today's actual show, you already know. But new dog leashes will be – the pre-order will be going out this week for those. Pre-order is going to last a week, and then they will deliver the beginning of March. Got some new colors. We're going to see how they do. And then as we move further into them, there'll be other specialty short-run colors done. So, that's it. Boom.
That's it?
That's it. That's right. Red Wire Gear moment.
Well, Red Wire Gear moment brought to you by RedWireGear.com. All right. moving on to our topic, which is going to be medical kit necessities and modern changes. So we're going to skip all the other stuff and just talk about this stuff. First most important thing.
Knowledge.
Training.
Yep.
Get the knowledge. Get the skills. Before you worry about what to put in your medical kit, get the training. It is a common problem. We see it with Sean all the time over at the Tactical Medic, where he'll go to like gun shows. He sells tons of kits to people who are like, well, I just have this kit just in case I need it. It's like, well, but do you know how to use it? Well, no, but you know, I'll figure it out. No, you won't. Mm-mm. Or maybe someone else will come along and they know how to use it. That's my plan, you know.
Maybe.
Then I have it and then someone else could use it on me. And it's like, yeah, not a good plan. And these are real things that get said by a lot of people. Like Sean sells a lot of kits to people who have no idea what the hell they're doing. And of course, you always have that old school training mentality too. It's like, oh, I don't need no more training. I was in the Army back in 2008. I went through a CLS class. And I think we joked about this on the show that actually got deleted. But it's like, yeah, but that class was taught by either A, a suicidal corpsman, or B, an Army combat medic who hates his fucking life and he's fresh out of the schoolhouse and he doesn't actually really understand what the fuck he's talking about, right? So that's typically who you're going to get your CLS training from. And that CLS training is not necessarily up to date as far as what the new like Committee of TCCC recommendations are, all based on the command structure and the medical advisor for that particular unit's medics.
Oh, and it even goes beyond that. It's just the trickle-down effect, man. It takes forever for that stuff to come down to guys because we're more up-to-date on it than most of those guys are, unless they're at the schoolhouse or they're at that specific level. Because I've talked to medics. I talk to medics every chance I get. And I'm like, hey, do you guys – how many tourniquets are authorized by COTCCC? And they're like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, never mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember civil stuff. Never mind. Even like when Dobson, one of our old instructors and still friends, first training with us, and he was fresh out of the schoolhouse, man. He was an instructor at the schoolhouse. He'd already had a deployment to Afghanistan. He'd served in other capacities as a medic and then was teaching the live tissue labs at the schoolhouse at Fort Sam. Like, he had a lot of knowledge. And he came to us, and I was teaching about other hemostatics, and he was like,
I don't know what that is.
What are you fucking talking about? Yeah. Is there stuff other than combat gauze? I'm like, oh, yeah. There's a lot more stuff other than combat gauze. So there's a lot more that goes on in that world other than just, you know, what those people are taught. So all they're doing is passing on their knowledge to you, which may be limited.
Yep.
So first of all, yes, your knowledge, quote unquote, can be completely out of date. And not that if you were to use that information, you would not be able to help people, but there's better, faster ways to do it. Why wouldn't you want to know that? Plus, if you haven't practiced it a lot in all those years, that's like the guys who were like, I know how to fight because I wrestled back in high school 20 years ago. And you're like, yeah, it doesn't fucking mean anything. You know what I mean? Or, yeah, I used to box at a gym when I was, you know, in my 20s. It's like, and now you're 40? When was the last time you threw a fucking punch?
It sounds like you've been smoking 3 packs a day for the last 20 years.
It doesn't matter. Like, you're not going to lose the skills overall, but you can be pretty fucking rusty.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to get back out there, and you got to practice. You got to train, right? So you got to get the knowledge. There's a lot of companies like us at Independence Training that teach this information. So there's other opportunities to train with them. You know, off the top of my head, you got Triad Medical mm-hmm. Training out of Florida. You've got Precision Tac Med, also out of Florida. You've got Prepared Med Response out of Nashville, Tennessee. You've got, I think they might have just moved. I always forget where Kevin is, and I'm sorry, Kevin, if you're listening. You've got Dark Angel Medical. I can't remember where they're based out of, but they bounce all over the place. And you've got like Lone Star Medics, Caleb Kazi, over out of Dallas area. And he travels quite a bit as well. And so do we, right? You can always host us in your area. It's really easy to host a med class. We require almost nothing on your end. Like, if you want medical training in your area, email us, info@trainingaz.com. You would be surprised how easy it is to get us wherever you are.
Super simple.
We need very, very basic requirements for a classroom. Very, very. We have taught in barns with heaters going because it was snowing outside, to give you perspective on what we have. You know, we've taught them in the field with no electricity at all, just doing hands-on stuff with a laptop as a presentation.
Well, the whole wilderness first aid program is taught in the field.
So, yeah, the whole thing's taught outside. So it's like, you don't think you need a lot to get us there, man. We've taught in conference rooms. We've taught in back offices. We've taught in construction bays. We teach one for a company, an ironworking company here in Arizona, where we teach in their mechanic bay.
Nice.
Like, where they fix their big machinery and stuff, you know? And it's like, guys like working around us. We're teaching other dudes medicine. Like, dude, we're used to this shit, right?
Just need a little bit of space.
Need a little bit of space, you know? We can do the scenarios. We can do – we shift all the stuff where we're going. We have everything we need. And if you host us and it's an open enrollment class with at least 10 people for 2 days or 20 people for 1 day, you train for free. There's a lot of advantage to you literally just kind of helping us find a place and helping us get the word out. So, you know, consider that. If you're looking for training, a lot of people go, well, I'm looking for training here or there. It's like, well, here's an idea. Host us, right?
Here's a concept.
So to start with the updates of March. So if you don't know March, M, massive bleeding, A, airway, R, respirations, C, circulation, which is also the catch-all for all the injuries, and H, hypothermia or the treatment of shock. March, has also become, for some people, SMARCH, S-MARCH, which is scene safety. Or scene security and March, which is important. Some people want to add that extra letter so that they remember the other thing. Some people do March E or S March E or SMARCHY, and the E is then environmentals.
Okay.
Right. And then you have the new configuration some people are trying to mess with, which is MCR, ARH. I don't know how to say it. MCR, which is taking the C and putting it before airway and respiration. So handling all of your bleeding and then dealing with circulation to also include for hemorrhagic shock and things of that nature, and then getting into airway and respirations and hypothermia. The reality, oh my gosh, I'm yawning so much. The reality is we are trying to always constantly evolve everything in medicine. People in the field are constantly trying to figure out better, faster ways to do things. To give an example, right, when I first went through a CLS class, I was basically taught the same medicine that my father was taught 30-something years previous, you know.
Just with different equipment.
Totally. Really not, actually.
Not really that different, but
yeah. We were issued the same little green bandage pack.
The H bandage.
And
the shitty compression bandage.
It's like a fat thing of gauze with two giant cloth wings on it.
Yeah.
And then a green cravat.
Yep.
And like, that was the same shit my dad used. We just knew a few more things about what we could do with the thing. But overall, it was still like, do this, and then call for a medic. It wasn't shortly after that that people started getting issued. It wasn't even a full IFAC yet. It was like basic stuff like the Israeli bandage, the old powdery quick clot mm-hmm. and a cat tourniquet, which was like mind blowing to people. We were like, oh, what the fuck? This is awesome. We actually have med supply. We can fix ourselves. This is incredible. And it was just like, yeah, just like that was it. And then the full IFAX really hit. And then by 2006, everyone had different IFAX. So branch-wide, everybody had their own thing. Some people was more specific. You know, Marine Corps used a different bandage, and they included stuff for burns. You know, the Army was including stuff for IVs and NPAs and chest needle decompression and things like that. Everybody had something different going on. But everyone was offering the IFAC, which was the individual first aid kit. The IFAC concept really changed medicine because suddenly – everybody was responsible for their own wounds. And if you got hurt, use your kit on you. If your buddy got hit, used his kit on him. And so if there's a huge modern change around medical kit necessity, I would say right off the bat, it start with March and literally prioritize it. Like, do you have stuff to handle massive bleeding? If not, you need that stuff.
Yep.
Do you have stuff to handle airway compromise? If not, you need that stuff. Do you have stuff to handle respiratory compromise? If not, you need that stuff. Then you need circulation stuff. Then you need hypothermia shock stuff. But you don't need usually so much shit. I know, I'm yawning. John. Sorry, man. You don't need so much stuff that you can't carry the kit.
Yeah.
So the first thing to look at in medical kit necessities is contextualize the kit. Is this a personal kit? Is this a vehicle kit? Is this a home kit? Is this a business kit? And how many people is this kit supposed to service? Is it supposed to service one person, three people, five people, 10 people, whatever?
Boom.
And like in your kit.
This is my backpack like, kit. This is the kit I carry in my backpack all the time.
And so when you look at that, like that kit, like I can't carry that on my body.
No.
But you can carry that in your backpack.
Yep.
And most of the stuff you have in there, I have in a different variation or version in my ankle kit. Right. Then Drew has in a different variation or version in her purse. And the kids have a different variation in their backpacks, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So you have to contextualize the kit. When people go to build a kit and they want our help building a kit, one of the first things we always ask them is like, well, where are you going to keep this kit? In my vehicle. Okay, where in your vehicle? Do you want it on the headrest? Do you want it in the under the back seat? Do you want it under a front seat? Are you going to try to attach it somewhere? Because now you're looking at, I need a special pouch or box or whatever. Okay, and now how big is that and what's that going to allow for? So first thing we got to start is there. How are we going to contextualize this kit? Even our IFACs that we give out for class are not particularly contextualized. It's a pouch, red, high visibility with everything we need to handle March. That's
for,
it.
For one person.
For one person and one injury technically.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's like, that's it. But – that's not a kit I can carry around with me everywhere I go. It's not really a big enough kit for a vehicle kit. It's not necessarily all I would want to take into the backcountry. I'm going to add some things to that. So you have to contextualize where and how you're going to keep the kit. And then you have to contextualize the capability to access the kit and how many people it's going to need to fill if you're not following the true IFAC concept. And more importantly, the types of injuries. Like, I'm going to carry burn dressings in my vehicle kit because burns and vehicle accidents are likely. I don't carry burn dressings in my AFAC.
No.
Doesn't mean I'm not going to get burned or that's not a reality, but I'm less likely to need that out of my AFAC. And if I'm near a vehicle, I have my vehicle kit, so we're in business. So you have to contextualize that where you're going to put it, how you're going to access it, how many people is it supposed to service, and what are the realistic injuries that you're going to be building. Because if, you know, in some places we go for corporate groups, we put like three or four tourniquets in their kit.
Yeah.
Because the nature of the injuries they're likely to experience. In other corporate groups, when we build their kits or individuals, I'm like, one tourniquet is fine. Mm-hmm. The reality of you bleeding to death is high, very, very possible, but not as probable based on the type of injuries or situations you're going to find yourself in.
Yep.
Right? So that's important. One of the things you mentioned was, you know, asking people like, well, how many tourniquets do you know of on the approved list? For many, many years, it was only two, the CAT and the Soft T Wide. Now there's seven.
I think I know four.
Three of them are the ones we recommend.
Yeah.
That's the CAT, the Soft T Wide, and the TMT from Combat Medical. Those three we love. Love those tourniquets, man.
And then two of those are like surgical level specific, aren't they?
A couple of them, no, they're not. A couple of them are – they're all field stuff.
Oh, okay.
But out of the list of seven, I have never touched three of them.
I thought
one. And neither is anyone on our team.
Yeah, I thought the last time I'd read that list, I thought one or two of them were like not.
No, because remember, this is TCCC stuff.
Yeah.
So changes on tourniquets. One of the things that's being taught more about tourniquets now is the importance of tourniquets continues, but the importance of not prioritizing only tourniquets is the thing that's really being taught now and really pushed now. Like, yes, you need tourniquets, but it shouldn't be the only thing you're going to have. If you can only carry one thing, I'd rather carry a bandage, or I'd rather carry a gauze and a bandage. Like a flat pack gauze and bandage is like $10, fits the size of my cell phone, and is honestly way more important and way more multi-useful tool than a tourniquet. A tourniquet is a hammer; it only drives nails. But you know, a good flat pack gauze and a good flat pack bandage is my multi-use, you know, multi-tool. So that's really what I'm looking at. If I'm going to carry only one, I'm going to carry the gauze and bandage. Because, again, the way the tourniquets have really been focused anyway now in TCCC and other aspects is less focus on the tourniquet's all you need, right? That's all you need to stop bleeding. More focus on just getting the fucking thing on.
Yeah.
I was reading a report recently on pre-hospital, a civilian pre-hospital tourniquet application, and it was over 20% of tourniquets that were applied that weren't needed, so they weren't an arterial bleed, but they caused zero problems. Extra pain, but other than pain, which the three P's of trauma care, pain is the patient's problem to an extent, all right, is that out of those 20%, it didn't matter. They put them on. It still controlled bleeding. When tourniquets are technically listed as the BCD, a bleeding control device, that is actually what they are. Yes, they can shut down catastrophic hemorrhage, but they're not only technically for that.
Right.
So one of the big TQ changes has been that. You know, just getting the thing on. Another big TQ change has been not just the different tourniquets, but also different application. Whereas before it was like high and tight, high and tight, high and tight. High and tight under care under fire.
Yes.
Right? Under the cuff part of TCCC. Or in an emergency, like, oh my God, the blood's coming out. I need to get this tourniquet on. But during actual tactical field care, the second phase, or under you know, civilian type settings of medicine, if I can see the wound and I know the bleeding location, getting a few inches above the wound in case of retraction of the artery into the deep muscle tissue to make sure I still occlude that artery, but making sure that I can use that tourniquet to reduce a tourniquet and get it off.
Yeah.
So if – this is a rough thing here. If the tourniquet is going to be on for longer than 6 hours and you're hitting about that 1 to 2 hour mark, if by then you realize, hey, this is going to be longer than I think, you can go ahead and reduce the tourniquet. What that means is hopefully you've already packed and bandaged the wound itself. Mm-hmm. That's already going to help with the bleeding control. Then we're going to put a second tourniquet a few inches above the wound. We're going to get initial tightness. Then we're going to start removing one half turn at a time, observed for 30 seconds. One half turn at a time, observed for 30 seconds. The original tourniquet, probably somewhere high and tight. What we're observing on the wound is if there's any bleed through. If any bleed through starts, you now start turning and cranking on the second tourniquet that you have added closer to the wound. Until eventually this process is to remove that initial tourniquet. And this is only really done if you're worried about that long-term tourniquet application where you're going to lose potentially part of the limb or its function, not because of the tourniquet, but because of the wound.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Some people are like, well, the tourniquet causes that. No, it doesn't cause amputation. The wound is the problem, not the tourniquet. The tourniquet saved your life. The wound's the thing that's causing the problem. So now you have a tourniquet that's closer to the wound, thus reestablishing blood flow higher up and hopefully – above where the wound is, well, and thus losing less limb if it comes to that point.
That's almost a throwback to how I was originally taught to make an improvised tourniquet, was 2 to 3 inches above the wound.
Yes.
With my web belt and a fucking stick.
Yeah.
Right? And this is 1999 Marine Corps combat life-saving first aid class.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's how I was originally taught tourniquets, was you put it 2 to 3 inches above the wound.
And that was for a different reason, but yeah.
Yeah. So, eh.
So those are just some basic, you know, tourniquet changes. Also, if you haven't seen a cat in a while, right, if your CLS class was years ago, like sometimes we'll have guys coming to train like, oh, yeah, I've got, you know, my CLS bag still when I was in the Army back in 05 or 06 or whatever.
Gen 1 cat.
It's like an old cat. They got an Asherman chest seal. They got quick clot powder. You know, I'm like, dude, the only thing really in here that's still valid is the Israeli bandage, which has changed zero, right? I mean, they've updated and added some new versions of it, but the original bandage is still freaking same because it's awesome. But other than that, like, yeah, man, stuff changes. The cat is in its seventh generation. The soft tee white is in its fourth, technically fifth generation. There's a lot going on with this equipment, man. We're constantly updating it as well. The assessment changes have been a big shift. Much more focused on the aggressiveness of raking, right? Much more focused on, like, causing pain and causing bleeding. Trying to find wounds, not being gentle about it, removing clothing, circumferential, pressure where you're grabbing around legs, grabbing around arms, not raking just there, but grabbing and raking, you know, trying to really find the source of injury. So that's a big assessment change, definitely that has happened, more aggressively looking for, you know, what the wound site is and where it may be, so we don't miss things. And people in the field are missing things under dark and all that kind of stuff. It's definitely a problem. Needles for decomp. So your decomp needles during the respiration phase has changed significantly over the last handful of years.
Bigger gauge and like 1.5 times as long?
No, not quite. So the original needle was 3.25. The newer needles are 3.75.
Okay.
They went from 14 gauge to 10 gauge, right? So much larger needle now. Jesus. Much longer needle to help reach that pleural space.
Yeah.
That's been a big shift. Another shift is, if it's worth chest sealing, it's worth needling. And in that initial, not the initial care under fire, but during that tactical field care phase, if you're sealing stuff up, which is where chest seals are done, seal the box. And then drop a couple needles in. Anything worth needling once is worth needling twice. So it's like seal them up, drop a couple needles. One of the largest changes here due to clotting, missing the site, other related issues, getting access to the site, really thick, heavy muscular tissue in the chest area, things like that, has been the change in needle site. So instead of the initial, mid-clavicular line, 2 to 3 inches below the mid-clavicular line between the second and third rib is now, and that being the primary, is now the secondary, the ancillary location alongside the actual side between the fifth and sixth ribs, still, midline along the fifth and sixth ribs. That has proven to be more effective and avoid a lot of the problems that they were having with, the primary location. Big, so
Beefy dudes,
clotting, getting caught on stuff, missing the wound or missing the pleural space, all that kind of stuff. Much easier to get in there on those side locations. I mean, that's where we put chest tubes. So obviously, if we're putting chest tubes there, a needle's going to work better there anyway. So that's an important factor. Other things that I would say are kind of medical kit necessities, not really even big changes necessarily, but medical kit necessities. Hey, Drew, can you grab the door for us?
Yeah.
But big medical kit necessities are going to be things like bandaging and gauze.
Yeah.
And the capability to pack and bandage a wound is wildly under-practiced and wildly understated in the importance of bleeding control and managing pretty much all those other wounds. So, obviously a huge shift in focus onto those kinds of things with even better products now and better capabilities. And you need way more training with that. One of the ways you can train with that, because a lot of people are like, well, I don't have all the cool trainers you guys have or whatever. But one of the things that we do, and we always show this in our classes, is we grabbed a couple of yoga blocks that are like $5 to $10 from your local Big Five or Dick's or whatever you've got on Amazon. And then grab an X-Acto knife and just chop up,
cut some holes.
It cuts all kinds of crazy stuff. We've got big cavitated wounds. And on one block, we can get like 3 different wounds, So we've got like thin impalements, big cavitated wounds, small punctures, large lacerations, long cuts, short cuts. I mean, you can really get like five different wounds easily on a wound cube or more, and they're still functional as a yoga block.
Yeah.
And you've spent hardly any money, and now you can practice packing and bandaging and working through that process, and you can help other people learn as well. So, you know, with tourniquets, it's obvious you just use the limbs that you have available, yours or whoever else's, but packing and bandaging don't get practiced enough, and that's a pretty serious issue. So, and there's all kinds of different, you know, changes that have happened in medicine, different products that we're using. I mean, man, we could go on all day about it, but understand that the American College of Surgeons, ACS, the COTCCC, Committee on TCCC, and the NAEMT, National Association of Emergency Medical Technicians, all three of those organizations release these reports every single year.
Yep.
If you're not getting refreshed training from an organization like us or any of the other ones I mentioned or someone who's similar to us, you need to be reading these reports. We gather a lot of data from these reports about what tourniquets are working, how they're being placed, how many turns, you know, what chest seals are working, which ones are coming off, what needles are working, what's happening, everything. That's how we're learning more and more, is by going over the data. If people are dying, how and why? We can't stop from dying if we don't know more about how and why. Yep. I mean, I remember when I first learned about medicine, like the treatment of shock due to hypothermia was not a thing. You know what I mean? It was just not a thing. We just didn't really do it.
Or you just elevated people's feet.
And then people are dying on a medevac, or they're dying out in the woods or whatever. And everyone's like, what the fuck, man? We handled all these wounds. Why'd they die? It's because their internal core temperature drops so much that their body shut down. You never really thought to totally handle that. And now it's like, yeah, at the very least, you need an emergency blanket, which is a piece of shit, by the way. But yeah, a 99-cent emergency blanket is a total piece of shit. Now, active rewarming is incredibly important. But like one of the big focuses right now on active rewarming is not putting active rewarming things against the skin, because now you have patients showing up to medevacs, field hospitals, et cetera, with fucking burns because people are putting hot packs right against their skin. So we have to be smart about it. We're trying to reheat the body through the main vents, which is the V-notch of the groin, the V-notch of the neck, and under the arms and the armpits. Those are the main, you know, heat vents. We're trying to rewarm that. We can add heat packs. Some of my favorites are the Warrior Ice heat and cold packs. Actually, the both hot and cold packs are my favorite because they don't burst because there's no water in them. You have to add water, which you got to have access to that, but it'd be fucking gross, disgusting river water. It doesn't matter. And now I can have on-hand heat and cold for treatment of hypothermia or hyperthermia or joint injuries and things like that. So really cool products out there that you can carry with you that you throw a little bit of water in and pow, I can start treating someone for hypothermia. The 99-cent emergency blankets suck, but they do reflect existing heat back. There's better blankets. The Adventure Medical Kit heat sheets are awesome. There's the actual USGI casualty blankets. There's the Mylar blankets. There's the Blizzard blankets. I mean, there's all kinds of great products out there that are going to help you to reflect that heat. There's the heat sheet blankets, right? Like I have a blanket in my truck that the whole thing is like one of those oxygen activated or air activated, you know, hot hands basically. So you open that thing up, wrap somebody up in it, then throw them in a Blizzard blanket. I mean, dude, you're going to freaking smoke them out. You know what I mean? Like you got to be careful about sending them into hyperthermia at that point. And that's so warm, which is what we want. Not to send them into hyperthermia, but to be able to add that heat back into the body. And so you've got that much heavier focus, I would say, in the last decade or so, of treating people for shock due to hypothermia, which is incredibly important. Everybody should be treated for shock, and primarily that is maintaining body core temperature. Other products or just other aspects of things that are like super important in medicine, outside of training and getting the right kit contextual and then understanding what's changing, and we haven't even covered all the changes, but understanding what's changing and how, is making sure that you maintain your kit. It's not a set and forget item.
No, God, no. Some of the items to a degree are.
Your bandages are never going to go bad.
Yeah, your tourniquet's never going to go bad. Your tourniquet's not going to go bad. And then it's a proper storage issue. Like, don't leave it on your dashboard.
Right.
Right. Like
extreme heat, extreme cold.
Yeah, just go through, check your stuff quarterly. Yeah. Build a habit of making it quarterly. And then that way, if you get busy, you'll remember to do it at least every 6 months.
Yep. And that way you have the capability to go through, make sure the packages on stuff that's important, like your hemostatic gauze, are still intact. Mm-hmm. You know, your chest seals still have good adhesive. Your tape is still working. If you have gloves in your kit, they're not totally decomposed. Your survival blankets aren't decomposed, all that kind of stuff. In addition to maintaining your kit on a regular basis and reviewing the contents, is also make sure that you stage it properly. Mm-hmm. Like, I take almost everything out of the package except for hemostatics because air activates them because there's moisture in the air and moisture activates it. So, you know, it's other than hemostatics that would stay intact, everything else gets taken out of the package. Because I'm not worried about sterility. That's not my concern.
Right.
My concern is in an unsterile environment with an unsterile wound, an unsterile patient, an unsterile me, I don't care about sterility. I'm just handling the problem. Infection and sterility, that's a hospital problem, and they'll handle that effectively. Doesn't mean I'm going to be stupid or negligent with the wound.
I'm not going to go around spitting and rubbing dirt.
Yeah, I'm not rubbing dirt in it, but on the other hand, I'm also not super concerned about whether or not my products are sterile. Because even if I have a sterile product, if I'm in the field and I open it, unsterile, right? So I'm not concerned about that. On things I do have to keep in packages like hemostatics, I will throw big duct tape tabs up on the outer edges that I'm going to have to be like retard grabbing and opening with my bloody hands or my mouth or whatever. So I want this to be a pretty easy job. But staging your equipment, put the most important stuff up top, right? Shears and tourniquets should always be right there at the top, you know, then gauze and bandages, chest seals. Anything else that's more administrative, your blankets, your casualty cards, all that kind of shit should not be the first available things up front. Your duct tape, you're going to tape stuff on with. That should not be the most available thing. Gloves, if that's a concern for you, gloves should be right there on top. You don't be digging through your kit trying to get your fucking gloves out. Make sure your gloves are the right size. Make sure, again, they're not decomposed. Carry a couple sets at least. If you're with somebody else, like Drew and I in a vehicle, I've got to have two sizes now of gloves in my kit, some that fit her and some that hit me or fit me, hopefully, if we're touching other people, which may or may not ever happen.
Right.
So there's a lot of considerations with both modern updates and kind of basic medical kit necessities. What we tell people, I'll wrap up my bit with this, is to say there's five things we consider absolutely necessary in a med kit. Tourniquet, mm-hmm. bandage, gauze, chest seal, some kind of occlusive seal, and gloves if you're going to be touching other people because you don't want to get nasty stuff. Or if you're not going to be touching other people, shears. If I was going to pick five things, not touching other people, shears, touching other people, gloves. My additional five things, if I have room, space, budget, whatever, are shears, if I haven't already added them in the previous list, some light source, some type of blanket to keep people warm, hemostatic gauze.
Yeah.
Right? I definitely want hemostatic gauze given that opportunity. And light source could be a chem light, flashlight, headlamp.
Yeah, 99 said headlamp with fresh batteries in it.
Yeah, whatever you got, right? Yeah. And then build on that based on your environment. Do I need burn dressings? Do I need more bandages, more gauze? Yes is always the answer to more gauze. You always need more gauze, always, always, always. But other than that, like, yeah, it's like, what else do I need contextually? Do I need heat packs? Do I need cold packs? You know, what else can I put in this kit? What's going to make it realistic for me to carry around? Because like I said earlier, I'd rather have a flat pack bandage than a flat pack gauze. And that's it. Then have a tourniquet.
Yeah.
Because I'm more likely to use the gauze bandage. That's pretty much it, man. That's all I got.
I can't add anything to it. I learned a couple of things today.
There you go. All right, guys. Remember, you can always bring us out to train with you like we talked about. Get hosting information via email info@trainingaz.com. We'd love to come out and train in your area. Hosting our medical classes is so freaking easy. We already travel around the country, man. We've got the situation, we've got the process, down pat. And it's not a tough situation for us to handle. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and Instagram as The Arms Room Show, Independence Training, and Redwire Gear. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Make sure you check out the other shows that they have on the network. Next week, technically this week, we talked about commonly overlooked emergency prep items. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how to take care of you and your tribe in that way. But actual next week, which we already said on the previous show, we're going to have one of our instructors, Chris, in the studio with us talking about vehicle fighting concepts, how to work in and around a vehicle should that become a necessity for your survival.
Sounds like a party.
Until next time, stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to The Arms Room.